Robots Radio. Games. Lore. Stories. Community. Just press play.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, weary traveler. Need a short rest? Oh, I see. They said you'd be showing up about now. Come on, through the portal. Best not keep the Lore Mistress and Lore Master waiting. You know how they get.
Robots Radio presents the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. The best way for everyone from experienced dungeon masters to those curious about D&D to learn more about the worlds, creatures, and lore of Dungeons and Dragons.
Hello and welcome to the Dungeons and Dragons Lorecast. My name is Sergio, and I am joined this week with an old friend, an old traveler, has wandered into the tower once again. Say hello, good sir.
Hello, how you going? This is Stuart. It's been
a while. It's Stuart.
I love what you've done with the place. It's looking fresh. It's
looking good. Mary put the curtains up. It was definitely a choice. wouldn't have been mine, but you know, it's definitely a choice. Thank you so much for coming on. I wanted to reach out to you to see if you were interested in and coming back to the tower to talk some lore, and it just happens to work out that you've got an amazing new project right now as well. So very, very serendipitous. But really quickly before we jump into the episode, what you got going on?
Yeah, for sure. So up on Kickstarter at the moment is the Abbott Trilogy, which is a collection of three adventures. They're system agnostic adventures, meaning that you can pretty much run them with any fantasy RPG. And that's for ZineQuest, and it's doing really well. It's funded. Two of the three stretch goals have been reached. It's going well.
Yeah, and I personally, I've already backed it. It's without question, because, and not just because, you know, you're an old chum, you're an old a friend, but I have two of your previous products. I have the zombies, What's So Rotten About Zombies, Defending an Ancient Temple, and I have Wretched Wasteland. I'm like trying to think, like, I kept wanting to say Wasted Wasteland. I'm like, that's a dumb name. You would never call something that. Wretched Wasteland.
Wasted Wasteland sounds like a game about getting drunk, I think. But
right. And I have both of those. And I mean, the writing is top notch. The artwork stands out beyond a lot of self-published stuff that I've seen. It's got that sort of almost black metal like vibe to it, aesthetic to it, which I love. And so even if you weren't an erstwhile host, even if you weren't a good friend, this would be worth picking up. Absolutely. We'll talk a little bit more about it at the end of the show. And of course, links to the Kickstarter and all that in the show notes for sure. Cool. And you'll have it's fully funded. You still have a couple more days to back it. But
yeah.
We are talking lore. We're talking the Sunless Citadel, which I asked you what lore topic you'd be interested in talking about. And you brought this up, which was interesting. So why the Sunless Citadel?
So it's partly because my mind has all been about adventures and stuff for obvious reasons over the last few months. It's also because I've never... So this adventure, it was originally written for 3.5 by Bruce R. Cordell.
Yep.
And then re-released with the Yawning Portal for 5th edition, and that's where I found it. So I've played it a lot with the 5th edition, and it's an adventure that I've run a heap of times. It's kind of my starting adventure. If I've got a new group, I still run the after school D&D club, so I'll often run that adventure as an intro to D&D, and I'll get kids to run it as an intro to D&D because I think it's written really well, and it's laid out, and the pacing's quite good. Has a good mixture of combat and social stuff. And I've never really dived into the lore. It's interesting. There's not a lot of, it's not lore heavy. However, if you dive deep, there are a few little bits in here that are pretty interesting. And it also puts some of the more common D&D monsters lore in action, which we'll talk about a bit later as well.
Right, right. But yeah, like you said, it's widely considered one of the best intro D&D adventures. Like you said, originally written third edition days. It got updated in Tales from the Yawning Portal. But if you haven't, if you recently started with D&D with 5th edition and you haven't played older editions, or you haven't gone through Tales of the Yawning Portal, this adventure involves a once proud fortress that has fallen into the earth in an age long past. Rechristened the Sunless Citadel, its echoing broken halls now house nefarious races and malign creatures. Evil has taken root at the Citadel's core, which is deep within a subterranean garden of blighted foliage. And it's here that a terrible tree and its dark shepherd plot in darkness. So this tree is called the Gulthias tree, and we'll get into the lore of that here in a little bit. And then the shepherd is this twisted druid, Belak the Outcast. And Belak the Outcast is an interesting character. Not a whole lot of lore on him outside this adventure. But I love that archetype of a, and we discussed shadow druids in a previous episode.
Okay.
So that idea, that archetype of a druid who, went against his clan or his teachings. So Belak was drawn to the buried citadel 12 years ago, following stories of oddly enchanted fruit to their source. And what he found was this age-old fortress that was pulled below the earth by some past magically invoked devastation. And with its ancient inhabitants long dispersed, vile and opportunistic creatures common to lightless dungeons infest the subterranean ruins, the aforementioned kobolds and goblins that whose lore is on display here. But at the old fortress's core is where Belak the Outcast stumbles upon the Twilight Grove. He discovers the grove's heart, which is the tree, the Gulthias tree, which is sprouted from a wooden stake used to slay an ancient vampire. And upon the Gulthias tree, magical fruit extrudes forth. A single perfect ruby-red apple ripens at the summer solstice, and a single albino-like white apple ripens at the winter solstice. Now, the midsummer fruit grants you vigor and health and life, like the superfood, essentially, like the acai berry, but yeah, for D&D. Exactly right. While the midwinter fruit takes that from you, takes your vigor, takes your health, takes your life. And so in the years since Belak's arrival, the enchanted fruit has enjoyed wider dispersal in the surrounding lands, promoting both good and ill. but the seed of either fruit, followed to sprout, springs forth only ill. Vaguely humanoid and evilly animated stick bundles known as twig blights eventually spring forth. So that's the start of the adventure, which, I mean, it's got, like I said, it's got dark druids, it's got vampire lore, it's got evil trees. Yeah. I mean, like, I could see why this became so popular.
Yeah, and it's that sort of sets the scene for the DM. And when the adventurers arrive, they don't know any of that. All they know about is that the Sunless Citadel exists, that people go adventuring there, and that there's these, depending on which hook you take, there's these goblins that come out of there and trade the fruit with them once a year. And I really love that setup. Like, you come to this, like, the town that's in there is called Oakhurst, and it's a pretty average town, really. It's a good starting town, because it doesn't have a huge amount of options in there, and there's a few little quest hooks that'll set you off towards the Sunless Citadel.
Some of those little quest hooks will be like cattle herders won't graze their stock too far, from their fields. You know, they're being frightened of the stories of new monsters that skulk the night. And even though no one has seen the creatures or like leave any kind of discernible trail, still cattle and people, for that matter, who have been caught out alone have been found dead the next day, pierced by dozens of needle-like claws.
Yeah. So the adventure has three hooks, and they're you know, one's just like you're adventurers and you want to go there. One is that you're contracted to find another adventuring party, and the next is solving the mystery about the missing fruit. So essentially what happens is when they trade for one of the pieces of fruit with the goblins, whenever they plant the seeds, it gets to a certain height and they wake up in the morning and it's gone. So they think, oh, by the way, this is super spoiler heavy. So we're not holding any bars here with spoilers. So if you...
this, we're going into details on the plot points of this adventure and its lore. So if you ever plan on playing in it as a PC, you might want to not... I mean, if you are... almost forever DM, I have found myself to be. I do have one game where I get to play on a fairly regular basis, and thank you so much, Brian, for that. But if so, then yeah, like this is a great starting point for folks who want to DM for the first time, or have a couple of people who are interested in playing D&D but don't know where to start.
Yeah. So just keep that in mind. We're gonna pull this thing apart a bit and talk all about those things. So it's actually that the twig blights grow out of the seeds from the fruit. So they're not getting stolen. They're just turning into twig blights and running off into the forest, which is why they're everywhere. So as you go adventuring and making your way towards the Sunless Citadel, you'll be attacked by twig blights, and you'll find twig blights in the Sunless Citadel as well. So the background, so there's heaps of background lore about what this structure was, and it was essentially a cult of the dragon temple. So throughout this dungeon, there's all this dragon iconography everywhere. There's
right, like illusions. Statues.
Yeah, like statues and things, you know, carvings through walls and whatnot. And then for whatever reason, there was a major catastrophic event, and it fell into the earth. And that's actually, it's actually pretty important, sort of, not really, like it depends at where you go, but if you find certain things in this adventure, it does become important. It also explains why the kobolds are there. So there's this group of kobolds. I'm going to butcher this name, but I think it's Yuzdrail, kobold.
We've gone over this plenty of times, Mary and myself, and even Sean. These names are all made up. None of these names are real. You could say them however you want for the most part.
No one's going to get these. We're not going to offend them. So there's these kobolds living in there, and they've set up like a bit of a hierarchy. There's someone that sits on the throne, which is Uzdrael. And they are in conflict with a group of goblins who have set up a bit deeper into the dungeon. My understanding of this is that kobolds may have come from the surface and or earlier come from the Underdark, because there is a little access to the Underdark in this adventure, and the goblins have come afterwards, and they're in sort of constant conflict, and they're the two sort of main parties that are the social complexity in there. So part of the cool thing about this adventure is actually the first time I ran this adventure, it was one of the first times I ran D&D, and everyone just got slaughtered. So they killed everybody. They were like, monsters. And it was also the player's sort of first time to
play. Yeah. And this is a very early level. I mean, it's recommended as a first level adventure. It says that if you want them to have a slightly easier time, you can start them at second or third level. This is a pretty low level, and as a result, could be deadly.
Oh yeah. 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 There's some stuff in here that's super challenging, really. But starting off, they come across some giant rats and a skeleton, and that's all pretty tame. But they're first into, so the whilst the first time I ran this adventure, they just slaughtered everybody. After that, the very first kobold you come across is a little crying kobold called Meepo. Now, Meepo was the person in charge of Calcrix, who is a white dragon wormling that they had as a pet, and it was stolen by the goblins. And that sort of sets up the conflict between the goblins and the kobolds. And I loved it because instantly you're like, oh, so Meepo is like, yeah, come and help me. We'll go speak to Uzdrael, and we'll get, we'll just chat with them. And so it changes this idea of the monsters being things that you have to kill to being someone you go and hold court with, because there's all this stuff in there about how to interact with the kobolds.
Which is definitely out of the ordinary for most parties I say like the adventure was written, like we said, initially in the 3E days, which it seems like now the idea of sort of befriending this weeping kobold and making it like a mascot of the team is a more of a 5E trope, fifth edition trope. Yeah. Like I feel like the players nowadays would really hold on to that rather than like, no, let's just kill everything in our path. It's a little ahead of its time in that regard, for sure.
For sure. Meepo has often become a member of the party and like a prized protected NPC for the players in numerous games that I've run, which is cool. The other thing that's interesting here is it also shows you like the living quarters of the kobolds. It's not just like this it's not abstracted, like there's literally a living quarters where you can they offer you to stay the night, and there's this like stinky meat that is rotating on over the fire, and they're like, you're hungry, and it's like, oh, no man, I'm not. You can eat it, and you can get damaged by it.
Yeah, roll that constitution check.
Yeah, that's right. And as you go deeper and deeper, you come across you come across Dern, who is the leader now of the Durbaluk tribe of goblins. And even there, there's like layered lore there, layered history. So Dern actually usurped the leadership of this tribe. So when you meet them, you notice that his offsider like hates him, and you can then try and work in cahoots with them to overthrow this usurper. So there's lots of sort of layered social stuff in there that isn't just combat. Especially between those two parties. And this is the first layer of the dungeon. And I think it's really, you can play. I've played it just with this first layer a number of times and have not included Belak at all, especially if it's just like a one shot. So sorry, my voice is going croaky. And then there's this undercurrent of all the Cult of the Dragon. Now on this first level, there's a secret. There's a secret room that is actually really hard for a first part of like a first level party. It's exceptionally hard to open. And it's the sort of thing you'd need to come back to at the end of the adventure, I think, like when you're second or third level, because it is particularly challenging. And I don't think many, like, I think you have to get over it. You'd have to roll a 20 or something to unlock the door. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I don't recall too many people opening it. But in there, you find like a secret room that has a dragon priest who used to be an elf and turn themselves into a troll trying to uncover the secrets of the dragon cult. And in with they'll wake up when you open their tomb, and you got to fight this troll at level one, which doesn't go down very well.
It usually doesn't end well at all. I like the idea of you just having the top layer of this dungeon, the top level of this dungeon, being the whole adventure, especially as an intro to D&D, because you're able to, you know, get some of the mechanics down. You're able to get some role playing in, make decisions. Do we want to do combat? Do we want to use other options such as like persuasion or investigation? Do we want to try talking to interacting in a diplomatic way with these kobolds? And so you kind of get an idea of what D&D, like a microcosm of what D&D is and what it can be, all in one very easy to follow mini adventure. I like that a lot. And then I heard, like you said, then it gets a little hard.
Yeah.
Once the dragon cults complicate everything, to be honest.
Dragon cults do really make it hard to deal with. It's cool like that. And so there's this, one of the hooks is that there's another group of adventurers, Talgan, Sharwin, Karakas, and Sir Bradford, who have all gone in there before you. And on the first level, you can find the remains of two of them. One of those remains is under a pile of other remains that has an infested giant rat who's like, I think, who has like all these baby rats, which is super gross. And also, as a first level adventure, it's really cool because you've been fighting a few giant rats and you can take them down fairly easily. And then there's just like a boss giant rat that's slightly tougher and can like poison you and whatnot. But underneath a pile of bodies, you find one of those, the ranger, and you can sort of start piecing together what's happened to these adventurers. The second one that's on that level has been killed by Dern, the goblin leader. The only way you sort of recognize that is that he's actually wearing the guy's armor and his like signet ring. You can see this like this noble fighter's signet ring on a goblin. You're like, I think things have gone well for Targon.
let's talk a little bit about the dragon cult really quick. It's sort of you know, doesn't have necessarily anything directly to do with the adventure. You can just gloss over the fact that there was a dragon cult that built this temple and then never deal with it again. Mm. Or you can use it as a starting point to a much larger campaign, which I feel is a great choice in the design of this adventure.
So there is a named dragon in this adventure.
There absolutely is. So
who's like serious? This is what I mean. I never dived into the lore. It wasn't until last night. I was like, oh, they've actually named this guy. And I Googled them. I'm like, holy shit, that is a serious dragon.
This is a very serious dragon. Dragon by the name of Ashardalon, red dragon that was so powerful that mortals worshipped him. One of those mortals was Gulthias, the vampiric head of the cult. And there is a great quote from Gulthias, who says, necromantic metabolism and faith are indistinguishable. What is animation of fallow tissue, if not faith so pure and undiluted that it can reach past the grave?
Yeah, right.
That's some twisted thinking there.
And it explains the dragon, the dragon priest that's sort of living in eternity, like they're immortal essentially, that you find hidden.
So
they've been diving into that lore.
Ar-Shadalan was mortally wounded in a battle with a circle of powerful ancient druids led by a woman named Daed. It's unclear what happened to the body, to the dragon's body, but the great worm's heart was harvested and placed in the well-protected core of Nightfang Spire, which is the ultimate relic of his cult. So Golthias, the chief cultist, noticed that there was some residual potency remaining within the heart. The cult determined to follow Ar-Shadalan's lead into death, and so ritualistically, over the course of several years, converted the temple to a mass tomb. And then finally, they each took their own lives, all perfectly timed to a heartbeat. Then I love the way this phrase that something strange happened, as if any of that just preceded was not strange at all. It's possible that some enigmatic other planar agency is ultimately responsible for what happens. It could be that, you know, some elder god or elder evil, their attention was brought forth to this ritualistic sacrifice, but whatever it was, that ritualistic sacrifice awakened, for lack of a better term, the heart, supercharging it with negative energy. And Golthias, as the chief cultist, was raised to unlife by his own physical proximity to the heart. In fact, he gained some sort of link to it, to the now magical heart, from which he was able to draw untold negative power. And he began to use his power to raise other cultists back into unlife. And his goal was the renewal of the cult, but with an undead perspective, an undead twist. Unfortunately for him, but fortunately for everyone else, Golthias got himself staked to the earth in a distant place before he could get his plan off the ground. And for centuries, it seems as if that was just the end of that undead cult. But Golthias has recently returned. And where, pray tell, dear listener, was he? What place of the earth was he staked to? Well, if you guessed the Sunless Citadel, well, then you have earned yourself 15 lorecast points.
Yeah, man, it's so cool that's none of this is like explained. It's not like you have this is in the adventure. It's just that there's the name. I believe it's scrawled in blood on one of the first rooms you go into, and then you don't actually find the shrine to Ar-Shadalan until the second level, and there's a shrine in there. My thinking now that I've dived into that is that if you get into that secret room and find the dragon priest, it notes that the dragon priest still speaks Elven and Draconic, and has been entombed with a ritualistic dagger, a silver amulet, and four spell scrolls. And I'm like, maybe they're all the ingredients you need to start an adventure or a campaign that leads to either destroying or resurfacing Ar-Shadalan, which is such a cool little tiny little thing in there that you could turn into a whole campaign.
No, I mean, yeah, it's just little nuggets of lore that, like I said, like could mean nothing, just flavor text for the adventure, or something that you could extrapolate into a full-fledged campaign. It's yes. Awesome. I mean, that's the beauty of how the adventure was written.
Yeah, spot on. And like, there's just so many little bits in there. Like there's Calcrix, the white dragon wormling, who's been stolen by the goblins, and the goblins can't actually control them very well. And whilst it's a white dragon and not the most intelligent, you can communicate with it. So another thing that's happened is that people have just like made Calcrix into one of their followers, or, you know, or a part of their party, which I also loved. The same thing with, this is a terrible name and I don't know why this name is in there, but there is a bugbear on the second level whose name is, I'm going to say it's meant to be Balsag, but it
looks like something else.
Yeah. And I'm like, anyway, it's a poor name, but he has two trained giant rats called Grip and Fang. And what he does is he stands at the entrance to the Underdark. That's where his like hunting ground is, and goes into the Underdark hunting for things under there, which is just so freaking cool. It says that he attacks anyone that comes near him, but I've often run that bugbear as someone that doesn't do that, because he is an intelligent hunter, who's, you know, intelligent enough to tame and train two giant rats, and he's also wearing like deer antlers as like a crown, because it makes him scarier. So I've often run that guy as someone you can interact with, who's not going to be your friend, but can
be. Not necessarily an automatic antagonist.
Yeah, because like I just think it's far more interesting to have this, you know, subterranean hunter to sort of give you some information for a price about the Underdark. Because I feel like if you're dealing with the dragon cult, you're probably going to go to some pretty nasty places. And then there's also a few other little odd things. Like there's Erky Timbers, a gnome who's been trapped by the goblins in there, you can find. He doesn't have much to say about the outside world, more just about the adventurers that have gone missing. And another thing and the cool thing about him is he's also someone that often becomes a part of the party. Doesn't have a lot going on for him. He can do like turn undead and has a few spells. But he, you know, is quite handy. And then there is, oh, that's the other thing. Calcrix. If you kill Calcrix, which I, you know, you might have to, because Calcrix is quite violent. And
I guess depending on how the DM runs the creature.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think it's she, actually. I think Calcrix is a she. She has a scroll, right, that has the a dwarven rune on it that says Kundrakar. And then if you open it and you can speak dwarven, there is a part of a letter that can be transcribed, and it's signed by someone called Durgadin. Have you ever heard about Durgadin?
I have not.
Durgadin Foehammer is a Greyhawk character called Durgadin the Black and the Wrathful Smith, leader of a dwarven group of refugees that fled the destruction of their hold 2 centuries ago. They found caverns beneath the Stone Tooth and founded a new hold known Kundrakar. There, dedicated to the creation of arms to slay the enemies of dwarven kind. Why does this white dragon wormling have this? And this is another thing that I just sort of glanced over throughout my time playing this. But that's pretty wild to me that this exists. It can be used.
Some random dwarves.
It can be used as a quest starter for the next adventure in the Forge of Fury. So it can be used for that. But if you're not planning on doing that, you've got this other little tiny, maybe found item that could be head down another completely different path, which I also love. And there's one other sort of strange creature that you find in this adventure, and it's a fire snake. A fire snake is a pretty serious monster to come across if you are level one or two. Have you ever spoken about a fire snake before?
They have not covered fire snakes.
So
I feel like we could do the show every week for years upon years, upon decades, and still not cover every single thing.
Exactly right. So it's an elemental. It's only challenge rating one. However, it has a multi attack, so it can attack with its bite and its tail, which does essentially, it does 1d4 plus one like piercing damage, and then 1d6 fire damage, and does that for both of those attacks. So if you're still level one when you get to this thing, that's pretty serious. It's and it's immune to fire, so your first level mage with firebolt is out of the game instantly. And I couldn't understand, like, there's a little note that explains why it's there, and it's because it is a greedy animal. So it's a greedy monster, and it loves jewels and gems. And so Balak has just like placed all these jewels and gems near it, and it is just like hoarding them. And so Balak has essentially created a living booby trap with this fire snake. It's a hideous, it's actually even got a heated body. So anyone that stands near it takes 1d6 fire damage as well. So even your fighter running in to fight it can get, cop quite a bit of damage just for engaging in combat with it. And that these are the little odd things that at first glance, I'm like, I remember when I first ran this, probably the first handful of times I ran this, I never used the fire snake because I'm like, this does make sense to me. But as you dive into the lore more and more, it does actually start coming together.
That being said, we're going to take a quick break and go to the middle of the show. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about the Sunless Citadel. We're going to talk about the Golthias tree, some of the lore behind this pretty awesome and evil plant that will definitely kill you, and some other cool stuff. We'll be right back. Welcome to the middle of the show. Of course, this is where we do all of our midly housekeeping stuff, like thanking the listener. Thank you so much for supporting the show by listening to it. If you want to support the show in other ways, there are many, many other ways to do so, such as joining the Discord and continuing the conversation with the Lorecast community there. Always fun stuff there. We've got advice on how to DM, on how to run adventures, on building characters, building NPCs, memes. It's your one-stop shop if you are interested in talking lore and talking D&D pretty much. You could also follow us. We are at D&D Lorecast pretty much everywhere. Your X's and Blue Skies and TikToks and Instagrams and all that. We don't have much figured out, but we do have the branding figured out, so that's good. So if you look for D&D Lorecast, you'll pretty much find us. You can also leave us 5-star reviews on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts, wherever you happen to get the Lorecast from. And lastly, but not least, if you really want to support the show in a very special way, you can go to patreon.com/DnDLorecast and sign up for the Patreon. We have tiers all the way up from $5 all the way up to 75 with a bunch of cool benefits. In fact, let's give a quick shout out to our newest patrons. Want to give a shout out to Chips and Denise and Ian, Sebastian, Atari, Brian, Caro, and Joe. Thank you all so much for recently joining the Patreon. It is very much appreciated. It's incredibly humbling that You know, thinking back when I was sitting in my bedroom obsessively reading over D&D books, that anyone would care to support me to do that, to do exactly that. So thank you so much. Links to everything are in the show notes, of course, obviously. Let's move on to news for the week. Well, the biggest news is that they have officially announced release dates for all of the books. I was going to say for all the books for 2024, but there's one that snuck into 2025. Everything that they've announced so far now has an official release date. We are starting off in May, on May 21st, with Vecna, Eve of Ruin, which is a, normally these adventures go from first level through usually about 13th level. This one goes from 10th through 20th level, and it promises to be a multiverse hopping adventure to save existence. Vecna wants to do what Vecna always is trying to do, which is rule everything. So it says that you're going from Faerun, the Forgotten Realms, to Greyhawk, to Orth, to Ravenloft, and the Domains of Dread. It sounds a lot of fun. It sounds a lot like Die Vecna Die, which was the last adventure that kind of ushered in third edition, the last adventure in Advanced D&D, second edition, and ushered in third edition, and is kind of used as a way to explain, quote unquote, the differences between the two versions as far as, like, you know, in universe. So I think this might be something very similar, as you know, obviously they say that the new core books, which we'll get to that, the dates in a second, the core books are supposed to be completely compatible with fifth edition. But I mean, there are going to be some changes, obviously. So I think that that's going to, the Vecna Eve of Ruin is going to explain those differences in universe, at least. Anyway, so that's May 21st. A couple months later, on July 16th, we get Quests from the Infinite Staircase, which is another anthology collection. It's a lot like Tales from the Yawning Portal, where they're taking old adventures, updating them to 5e rules for the newer players. And if it's anything like Tales from the Yawning Portal, it's going to be awesome. I love those anthologies. They make great one-shot adventures, convention adventures, and bringing back older adventures, like much-loved adventures, is always good in my opinion. And so the core books, the 2024 core books, have been announced. Release dates: we've got the Player's Handbook on September 17th, and then a couple months later, on November 12th, we've got the Dungeon Master's Guide. And then sneaking all the way into February 2025, on the 18th of that month, we'll finally get the Monster Manual. So we're not getting, unfortunately, not getting the core rule books all in the same year, all in the 50th anniversary of D&D. But they had mentioned this previously, up until like a year ago, that the print runs are just so massive that they really couldn't find any printer that could accommodate all three books at the same time, so they were going to have to stagger them. And the fact that they're coming out later, I would rather it be late and done right than rushed and having, you know, all these issues. So take your time, D&D, take your time, Wizards, when it comes to this sort of stuff. You know, we've still got, you know, everything else that we've got, and so do it right, because if you do it wrong, it's going to be wrong like forever. So our final bit of news for this week, there is now an official D&D live theatrical experience. It's called 20 Sided Tavern. It's going to premiere in New York City this spring. An article from Variety says that the cast will include 5 actors and more than 30 characters that may appear. The show boasts a fantasy world set in the Forgotten Realms, as well as puzzles, combat, riddles, and opportunities for audience members to join the cast on stage and test their strength or dexterity or wisdom or charisma. There will be a variety of games like trivia, charades, and fantasy beer pong, which will ensure that no two shows are the same. That sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds like a blast. And hopefully they take that on the road. Hopefully it becomes a traveling show. And because I don't live anywhere close to New York, and I probably won't be there anytime soon. So hopefully it's a success and begins to, like I said, travel around. Okay, now in terms of homebrew shenanigans, We're talking the Gothias tree, which is a type of blight. So I'm looking to see what kind of fun stuff can we find on the DM's Guild concerning that. Well, I found something from Glenn Cooper and Dreadful Dungeons, an adventure called The Tree of Blight, which you can own for only $2.95. A blood-curdling scream shatters our adventurers' rest as they set up camp for the evening. Without warning, the forest comes alive, and a heroic struggle begins as our adventurers battle to avoid becoming the forest's latest victims. Take your players deep into a cursed glade on a dark and stormy night to confront an evil druidess and a horrifically corrupt tree. So this is a 2 to 3 hour adventure for characters anywhere between levels 1 and 5. You've got maps, you've got traps, detailed NPCs to interact with, stat blocks, a brand new monster, loot, magical items. And it's got 4.5-star ratings. It's looks incredible, looks amazing. And I love the 2 to 3 hour time span. Like I said, I'm a big fan of one-shots recently for some reason. Running an entire experience within a 3 to 5 hour window, and something like this is perfect for that sort of thing. I know that in the campaign that I regularly play in, sometimes the DM will need some extra time to prepare for the ensuing adventures, or there will be one or two of the party missing. And so we'll run a one-off, one-shot. And so something like this is perfect to fit right in. So check it out. Links are in the show notes for all the stuff that we talked about, including the Tree of Blight. That being said, let's jump back to the show. Welcome back from the middle of the show. We're sitting with Stuart Watkinson. We're talking the Sunless Citadel. One of his favorite go-tos, one of the first adventures he ran as a DM, the start, the very humble beginnings of a master, of a game, of a expert game master.
Oh, why? Thank you. Great adventure, great adventure. We have been talking a lot about mainly about the first level of this adventure, which has a very different feel. It's all stone walls. There's kobolds and goblins in there.
It's standard dungeon fare.
It is. And like I've said, I've run that as its own, and it works perfectly fine if you just remove all of the Balak and the Gothias tree stuff. However, once you descend into the second level, it changes. The whole vibe sort of changes. Whilst it's still stone walls, they are stone walls that are filled with like a subterranean greenhouse happening. There's all these bioluminescent fungi that sort of light the place. There are a few fires around that are for lighting, but for the most part, you're sort of in this really strange neon colored greenhouse where there are twig blights that are commanding skeletons to work in the greenhouse. So it's a very, very, very different vibe. Very cool. It's much more dangerous, I find. So usually you'd want to have your characters leveled up to level 2 by now, if not level 3. But level 2 is suffice.
And that's something mentioned in the adventure, is that if you start at level 1, your players should usually progress to level 2, and like you said, probably end it at level 3.
Yeah, for sure. The confrontation with, well, we'll get to that in a minute. The other thing that you find in here on this second level is a dragon library. So leaning and fallen stone bookshelves fill this chamber. Though a clear path connects wooden doors on opposite walls, torn and burnt out pages, bindings and scrolls from disordered piles in the corner. There's not much you can find because most of it's destroyed. However, there is a tome of dragon lore bound in dragon scale and written in Draconic that can be found there. There's also, which is, if you're thinking of a Shardalon campaign, there's a little nugget that you can hang on to. And then also a Shardalon shrine is down here. I'll just read that one as well. Dragon carved granite blocks line this chamber's walls and ceiling, though many are crumbled and broken, leaving stony debris on the floor. A huge marble statue of a rearing dragon stands in the curve of the western wall. The eye sockets of the dragon are empty, but a red glow lingers there, providing reddish light throughout the chamber. The radiance casts an inky shadow behind the statue's wide wings. A 5-foot diameter circular tile of dark stone is set in the floor in the front of the dragon statue. Runes are carved around the circular tile's inner edge. It's pretty cool. You can actually get a boon here in that space. So whilst it seems ominous and scary, if you engage with it, you get a benefit. You can get get advantage on charisma checks for 24 hours. So another little piece that makes following this line of the dragon cult enticing, as opposed to terrifying as it should be.
Right, and just again, just another little lore nugget just embedded in that could mean nothing, or it could mean the rest of the campaign that your characters are playing in.
Yeah, exactly. And so you slowly move through here and you make your way into the grove where you find the Twilight Grove, which is where Balak and the Galthias tree are, along with two of the other adventurers who on first looks are gray and pale-eyed and don't look very healthy.
Yeah, these adventurers, if you hang around the town that where the adventure starts off at, what was it called?
Oakhurst.
When you start off in Oakhurst, you can, of course, you know, do the usual sorts of D&D things, talk to the tavern keep, talk to other citizens of the village, and you can get some information on missing adventurers. And these are a couple of them. You've got the adventurer of, goes by the name Sir Brafford. Of course, the name like Sir, he's in full scale mail. And then you've got Sharwin in leggings and a half robe, and they are not themselves at all. Seemingly, your characters are able to tell by looking at them that their skin appears rough and almost bark-like.
Mm.
And Balak says that they've been accepted by the Galthias tree. So the Galthias tree, so the legends tell of a vampire named Galthias who worked terrible magic and raised up an abominable tower named Nightfang Spire. We alluded to him earlier. He's the leader of the dragon cult, but he was undone when a hero plunged a wooden stake through his heart. But as the vampire was destroyed, his blood infused the stake with a dreadful power. In time, tendrils of new growth sprouted from the wood, growing into a sapling infused with the vampire's evil essence. It's said that a mad druid discovered the sapling, transplanting it to an underground grotto where it could grow. From this Galthias tree came the seeds from which the first blights were sown. Now, wherever a tree or a plant is contaminated by a fragment of an evil mind or power, a Galthias tree can rise to infest and corrupt the surrounding forest. Its evil will spread through the roots and soil to other plants, which then perish or themselves transform into blights. And as those blights spread, they poison and uproot other healthy plants, replacing them with brambles or toxic weeds or others of their kind. And in time, an infestation of blights can turn any land or forest into a place of complete corruption. In fact, forests that are infested with blights. Those trees and plants will grow with supernatural speed. Vines and undergrowth spread rapidly through buildings and overrun trails and roads. And after blights have killed or driven off their inhabitants, whole villages can disappear in the space of days. Blights are independent creatures, but most act under a Goliath tree's control, often displaying the habits and traits of the life force or spirit that spawned them. And so by attacking their progenitor's old foes or seeking out treasures valuable to it, they carry on the legacy of long-lost evil. And this is exactly what Velak, the outcast, is essentially obsessed with, what he's been tending, what has transformed Sir Bradford and Sharwin into these zombie-like shells of humanoids with bark-like skin. It's everything about this adventure is just chef's kiss.
It's super dark and creepy, but Velak himself, when you meet him down here, he seems quite I feel as if he's written a bit like a mustache twirling villain, but once you or really dive into this lore and figure out, oh, okay, no, he's got a master plan here. He's trying to make a full-on corruption, a ravine, vale, mountain. I don't know how far he wants this to spread.
He's this outcast druid. He mentions that his druidic society had expelled him because he dared to expand nature's reach in ways their puny minds couldn't grasp. And so it's taking the ideas, the philosophy of a druid, and twisting it into something that's evil, at best harmful, at worst completely evil, which is, again, something that really appeals to me, is that taking the idea of something that is supposed to be good, meant for good, and maybe ratcheting it up to 11, taking it to its extreme, taking the philosophy to its extreme, and seeing where it goes from there.
Yeah, we've talked a bit about campaign starters from this, and there is a single line in this that says, combat. If a fight breaks out, which will happen unless the characters actually submit to Velak. Now, what if your players did submit to Velak? That changes the face of your campaign completely, but I think also makes it quite interesting in that I guess it would become an evil themed campaign, but Velak then becomes your what's a good word for that? A
handler? Velak,
yeah, your handler. Yeah. Sending you out pimp, into the your villainous pimp. Sending you off into the world to do the what needs to be done for the Gothias tree and to spread that corruption. You become an evil druid's henchman. Which I think is an interesting sort of idea. People often want to play an evil campaign. I've had people ask about playing an evil campaign, and often the thing that goes wrong with an evil campaign is everyone just turns into murder hobos, which is uninteresting. When you go into every single town you go into, you kill everybody in the tavern and have to fight the guards.
Right. Well, you have to. And I've also run an evil campaign. You have to, there still has to be consequences to their actions.
Yeah.
Which they didn't realize. Really quickly, digression, evil campaign. Their first mission is to, they're hired by a jewelry store owner to essentially take care of his rival. And so they just show up to his shop and kill him in the middle of the street. And they show back up to the hideout, and their handler, their pimp, is like, "You are idiots. the city watch is now looking for you. You need to go clean this up. And so they go and figure out how to clean it up. And then moving forward, they're like, okay, we have to be more careful about how evil we are. We have to do this. We have to be evil, but in a smart way, which can be a lot of fun, to be honest.
Well, yeah, that, and this sort of gets me thinking about, like, okay, cool. Well, now it's your job to take these fruit out into the world and plant the seeds.
Right.
And perhaps you're going to different towns and different cities and planting these seeds all around the area, or perhaps you now have to stop the adventuring parties that are coming into the Sunless Citadel. It just opens up a lot of little interesting things. You may not want to be bark skinned, but that might make things a little difficult, and you know, gray eyed. But
well, I just said their skin was bark like, and you know, they're not, you know, ants walking around.
But yeah, ultimately, it's kind of cool because it sort of stats the tree. Ultimately, that if you take down the tree, you can actually save Sir Bradford and Sharwin from the tree and take down. Oh, the other thing about Black is he has a giant frog.
Right.
That's named Culcut, which I really like. I don't know why. I think it's cool. A giant frog is an interesting.
I mean, an interesting to have. Pet, like, yeah, a little.
Yeah.
As opposed to like a warg or anything typical like that. Yeah, like, this is a giant frog.
Yeah, the MCDM Beast Hearts character class has monstrous companions, and one of them's a giant toad, and we played like a pirate themed campaign. I say campaign, it was only about three adventures, but that's campaigny enough, where I had like this a giant toad as my companion, which was cool. Check it out, it's actually a really, really great addition to your character classes. And I guess that's what Balak's doing there with his giant toad.
Yeah, he does. He mentions that talking to the player characters, talking to the party, that your remains would enrich the compost, but you'll better serve my needs as supplicants. Plus, you retain your lives after a fashion. Surrender your weapons and submit peacefully, or it will go worse for you. So, yeah, I do. I mean. And again, like every time the players, you think the players are going to zig, they zag.
Yeah.
You know, the NPC that is supposed to be there to give one scrap of information ends up being one of the most important PCs of the entire campaign because the party absolutely falls in love with them. I mean, Jarnathan from the D&D movie is a.
Oh, yeah. He's getting his own book, I think.
Yeah. It's absolute, perfect snapshot of, and there's someone should name this sort of phenomenon, this NPC adoration that happens, but you know, you think the player's going to do one thing, they do something else, and it would be very interesting to have a PC party say, you know what, like, yeah, why don't we do this, let's go ahead and become these supplicants, become these weird type creatures and start sowing these evil seeds all across the land.
And you know, your party might actually have a druid and a wizard who's into necromancy, and you know, a cleric who's also a sort of a necromancer god worshiper, and this is what they wanted. Maybe it's a brand new quest hook. It's like, you need to go and meet Belak. Like, that's actually the quest.
Right.
The quest is like to go and meet him and see what he's doing and be like, are we taking the tree from him or are we joining him?
Right. Are we taking it for ourselves, for our own purposes, or are we joining the operation? Well, yeah. Gothias, our old vampiric friend, dragon aficionado, would say that necromancy and faith are indistinguishable, are one and the same. So,
yeah, there you go. He's for it. He's all for it. And that might be, yeah, okay. So this conversation really solidifies my idea about this being a great starting adventure, because it, you know, in the adventure you start in the town. I personally, for brand new players, I don't really like starting in towns because there's too much option,
right?
Which I know that's what the game's about, but like, the amount of times we've spent an hour and a half in town talking to random people and trying to buy things at the shop and being disappointed because it's a first level town.
Right. There's a time for the sandbox and there's a time for the railroad.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think starting off, it's good to a little bit of railroading at the very start of an adventure, especially a campaign. So I have often started this at the start of where, like, there's a little campsite above the ravine where other people have stayed, other adventurers and goblins have stayed. So I often start it there, and then they just and sort of do a bit of background information as to why they're there and make those decisions then with the players, and then just dive straight into it.
And you can have like story mechanics. I know we just ran for the Tales from the Tower actual play that we're running now. We did one of the adventures from Keys from the Golden Vault. And in that, they find a map from a previous adventuring party. And
yeah,
so,
I love that shit. Oh, that's
and
so,
so
good.
Yeah, so you could do something like that. You could find the previous party's notes or whatever it may be. And immediately, like, that's the information you need. It gives you all the story hooks. You know, the location where you need to be, and you don't necessarily have to talk to a dozen NPCs who only have, you know, four pieces of information between all of them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And like, don't get me wrong, I think that giving players as much choice as possible is great. But if you've got a new group of players, maybe, especially if they're new to the hobby entirely, that's kind of my thing, is I'm often running for people who are very new to RPGs, and it can feel a bit nebulous to them. Like, it can feel like there's just so many options, and
right,
and whereas I find getting them into a dungeon or to an adventuring site as early as possible can reduce that decision fatigue, you know.
No, absolutely.
But then in saying that, Oakhurst is actually a great one because there's not a lot happening and there's not a lot of options. And I didn't know this until yesterday when I was researching, but the third edition artwork is different, and it has some really, really handy stuff to explain things. Like the ledge I was just talking about that you camp at, there's a point of view piece of artwork of what that looks like. Because it is a bit, the description is pretty hard to figure out. But then it also has a tiny little point of view map of Oakhurst and an overland map between Oakhurst and the Sunless Citadel, as well as a cutaway map of the Sunless Citadel. So there's all these little things in there that just make this adventure a little bit easier to comprehend in your mind. So if you are keen on running this in fifth edition, I would get onto it's on the DM's Guild for $5 or something.
Yeah, you can buy a PDF of it.
Yeah, yeah. Get those little pieces of artwork are just going to make your, I mean, I honestly look like when I looked at this last night, I was like, oh man, that's so good. It just completely orients everything much better in my mind. And I have literally ran this adventure about 20 times, so that is saying something. It's very, very good.
Yeah, so you can find the fifth edition version in Tales from the Yawning Portal, which is an anthology of older adventures that have been revamped and redone for fifth edition rules. You can find the original third edition module, like Stuart said, on DM's Guild. Get yourself a PDF of that. Yeah, it's considered an all-timer because it's got so much. It can do so much and also be as simple as just a simple dungeon crawl. It can be just like easy, like run of the mill missionary style dungeon crawl from point A to point B. You know, you start at the beginning, you end, you kill some stuff on your way to the end, and then you got yourself the big bad. But then it could be so much more if you want it to. So again, it's the beauty of the writing. So, well, thank you so much, Stuart. Let's talk, before we wrap up, let's talk about the Abbott trilogy again, really quickly.
Yeah, sure. So the Abbott trilogy is three adventures, Abbott's Maw, Bitter Peak, and Still Hollow, and they are all linked. So Abbott's Maw is a relatively random generated hex crawl through a swamp, looking for someone called the Abbot, who is the troll priest. And that the troll priest becomes the essentially the quest giver that sparks you on an adventure, because he's like, look, I've got all this cool stuff that I can give you. None of my disciples will leave the swamp. So I would like it if you could go and get this stuff for me. He doesn't say it like that. He's not super polite. which sends you off to the Bitter Peak, which is a hex crawl, but more survival-y focused, crawl through a frozen tundra, to the peak of a mountain called the Bitter Peak, to find something called the Demon's Bane. And from there, it's off to the Still Hollow, which is the desert-themed adventure, and to find a god that is supposedly trapped underneath in the Still Hollow. They're all kind of linked. They were written individually and weren't connected in any way. And so my job has been over the last few months is to write all the connective tissue, which has been super fun because Abbott's Maw was the first one I wrote. And that's got quite a bit of like weird sort of sci-fi elements to it. Like whilst it's ancient fantasy, the stuff that's found there is like pretty sci-fi, you know, like there's clearly alien influences and strange ultra lightweight metals and you know, like laser blasters that only have a certain amount of charges and strange magics that's actually just technology. So weaving that stuff into all three of them has been really, really fun. So yeah, it's three separate zines. Running on Kickstarter. There is a whole heap of information on the Kickstarter. We have first stretch goal has been reached, which is a pamphlet called Untrodden Paths, which is a overland adventure pamphlet that you can use to generate quests and encounters while traveling between the three adventures. And then we've just done the second stretch goal, which is a map of. So this will be like a relatively generic, when I say generic, I mean, it's not placed, it's not going to be named as such, except for a few locations, which will be Abbott's Maw, Bitter Peak, and Still Hollow, or Map's Edge is the town that Still Hollow is near. And then I'm also going to put Largshire in there, which is another system agnostic thing I've made and Winterbrook, which is another adventuring site from another adventure. And then there'll be other little spots that are
the Stuartverse, as it were.
The Stuartverse, yeah. Yeah. It's that's essentially what it is. Yeah. Well,
I love it. I absolutely love it. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of What's So Rotten and Wretched Wastelands. I mean the writing's fantastic. The artwork is amazing. And the artwork that you posted for the Abbott trilogy looks just as good.
Yeah, awesome. I'm working with Kirill Changov again. We just get along really well. He's a great artist. He's in Belgium, I believe, and just has great style. He is really good at it. It's really quite uncanny how he can take the things that I say and write and turn them into what I see in my mind. It's really cool, and I love working with them. They've got so much art coming for this. We've got about eight pieces per book, and each book is 16 to 20 pages, plus a couple of maps. lots and lots of cool art on the way. So yeah, jump onto Kickstarter. It's running until the 21st of February, so there's about 5 days left. And yeah, exciting times. We also have teed up with Space Penguin Inc., which is a new tabletop RPG company and distributor, and they're in the US, so the shipping for US has now reduced from about $25 US to about $11 US. So if you are in the US, there is some good news for you guys.
That is good news. Like I said, I backed it as soon as it was launched, and not just because you're an old friend, but because quality is always there. At the time of this release, you still have a couple of days to back it. It's looks fantastic. I've been wanting, and it's system agnostic, so you can run it in any system, whether it be Dungeons and Dragons. I'm probably going to run it in Morkborg.
For sure,
easy. because I love Morkborg so much, and just like aesthetically, it seems like a better match. I can't wait.
If you are curious, you're like, I don't know how that'll work. I have written in the FAQ a little thing about what does system agnostic mean. And there's an example of a stat block. And also there's an example of how like a skill or a save might be used as well. So they're just written in ways that are easy to align to whatever system. And Morkborg. So easy because it's almost exactly the same sort of stat block.
Yeah, so I mean, the Morkborg or even Shadow Dark. I just received the Shadow.
Oh, Dark, yeah, Shadow Dark.
Which, and I've been dying to like play that as well. So, it's going to be a lot of fun, regardless.
Yeah. I'm hoping to have some of the PDFs at least in a. I think Abbott's more PDF without the artwork. Will be going to backers early as like a, hey, this is what you can expect, by the end of the year. Just so you can, so people can make a start and have a look and see how that goes, and also get feedback. I'm always keen for feedback before something's officially released. So that's, jump on board, folks.
Absolutely. Like again, links to all that are in the show notes. So definitely check it out. Support some indie tabletop role-playing games. And it's going to be a great time. It's going to be an awesome time. Stuart, thank you so much for joining. Thanks for talking lore, and thanks for talking Sunless Citadel with us.
No, thank you very much for having me, and thank you all for listening to my rambling.
they're used to it. They listen to me week in and week out.
cool.
And it is very much appreciated. That about wraps it up for us. Thank you so much for listening, and once again, thank you, Stuart, for joining us. Fare thee well, dear listener, and until we meet again, may all your 20s be natural.
Thank you for listening to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. If you've enjoyed the show, consider following us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at D&D Lorecast, or jumping into the Robots Radio Discord to chat more with us about Dungeons & Dragons. We'll see you soon.
You've been listening to a Robots Radio podcast. Smart shows for interesting people. Check out all the shows at robotsradio.net.